on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. You know, in today's world, we're so accustomed to flying at 25,000 feet or even higher. And with those pressurized cabins, we don't even notice a difference. But our guest today, B-17 Bombardier John Wagenhals, and all the other veterans who flew high-altitude bombing missions in World War II, did not have that luxury. Can you give us a sense of what those conditions were like without pressurized cabins, what you guys actually had to do just to even survive up there?
Well, yeah, it was like 50, 60 below zero, I guess, at that altitude. We had electric heated suits. They worked fairly good. And then, of course, we had leather fur-lined uniforms, pants and jacket, and we could hardly move. We had so much stuff on, but we were almost comfortable, you know, in spite of all the bad weather and all this kind of thing that was going on. So I don't think there was an effect as far as the temperature was concerned, although it was cold.
And that heated suit always worked for you, huh?
Most of the time.
Good thing you're from Glasgow, Montana, for the times it didn't.
So once in a while, they'd short circuit and you'd be dead, you know, the circuit would be absolutely dead. Yeah. And you'd have to just depend on your big wool leather jacket and leather pants to keep you warm.
You know, speaking of Glasgow, just total tangent here, but I'm just curious, did you get a chance to see Glasgow, Scotland while you were over that way?
Yeah, matter of fact, when we flew from Goose Bay, Newfoundland to Wales. We got on a train or something and we went to Scotland. And yeah, we were at Glasgow, Scotland for a while. And I made a big deal out of that. And then we were boated across over to England after that. So, yeah, I got to see it.
As far as some of these missions, and I talk about close calls, and I don't mean to make light of what you went through. I have to imagine when you guys are flying sometimes day after day after day, that there were some situations where you really did wonder if you guys were going to bring that plane back in. What are the ones that really stand out to you?
What really bothered me more than anything, I think, was the fact we were coming home, flying formation, and we were in an element of four airplanes. We were not the lead airplane. We were flying the right of the lead airplane. The airplane on the left moved over, and he got underneath the lead airplane. And he kept moving it up and up and up and up. We kept seeing this. Well, why is this guy doing that? He's underneath this airplane, and he's moving the thing up, making it go higher and higher and higher. Why is the guy doing that? So anyway, pretty soon, he went back to his position, and he was flying there for a little while, and the next thing we know, he's flying right into the lead airplane, and he crashed right into him, and they both tumbled down into the river, what is the river in London, Thames, yeah, he went into that thing, and that's been kind of a sad part of it. Was two airplanes almost home. What they probably said was the guy that was causing all this was probably having vertigo, and he didn't realize where he was in the air, and probably the co-pilot was sleeping, which wasn't uncommon, and so he was there probably pretty much alone, and he just couldn't tell where he was, and he was just all over the sky, and so he moved us over a time also too, for that matter, but not that far. Anyway, that was kind of sad to see these guys go down after they had flown the mission. Before, it'd be a different story, you know, because they might have got shot down anyway. But this way, to go down under those circumstances was not, that was sad.
Were there any survivors, or was that 20 guys?
There were a few survivors. Matter of fact, the pilot of that airplane, I've communicated with him too. He had taken the right-hand seat, the co-pilot seat, to give the other guy, the co-pilot seat, some pilot time because he wanted to get checked out as the first pilot instead of a co-pilot. So the co-pilot was actually flying the airplane, and it got hit on his side, and of course he got lost, but the co-pilot, who was actually the pilot, he got out and he survived. And I think they said there were like four or five people out of the two airplanes that survived.
And obviously he wouldn't have if he hadn't switched spots with the co-pilot. And did you have some moments like that kind of took your breath away and said, boy, that could have been me right there?
Well, all of them are like that. Yeah, we worried, you know, I don't know, you see the fighters coming in, you see the flak coming up, and you just know damn well you're going to get hit one of these times. It just can't go on forever.
Can you help us understand what it feels like when you get hit by flak? I mean, I imagine it's got to be pretty loud, and you can feel some vibration or maybe even something in your flesh at times, huh?
Yeah, you can feel it, and you can feel the explosion of the shell as it explodes, because it just explodes into a thousand little pieces. You can hear it, and you can feel it move the airplane a little bit. Not a lot, but you can feel it move it. I guess if you hear it, what they said, you don't have any problem. It's the one you don't hear that's probably got you. It was scary. It was very scary.
And you mentioned fighters coming at you, and there were times where you had escort up until a certain point. But again, I'm just thinking about you being where you are in the nose of that B-17 with probably the best view of anybody to see what's coming. Were there some close encounters with enemy aircraft?
They would fly. See, I was also a gunner. I had guns up front there. And so I was pumping away with the guns, and I'd see these guys coming in. I don't know. I probably hit some, I imagine. But it wasn't every time that we got hit with fighters, but it was often enough. It didn't like it. But, yeah, you see a lot going on, and all of a sudden you see an airplane that's not there anymore. So he's just puff, and he's gone.
What was the worst damage that your plane sustained in all those missions?
Well, we came home, I think, actually it was on the second mission to Berlin, or shortly after. I don't know how many holes was in the airplane, but one engine was shot out to begin with. Then pretty soon the other one got so it wasn't working very good, so we started throwing everything out we could to lessen the weight of the airplane to keep it flying. And so we put guns we could dismantle and flak suits on the way home. We threw them out and just about everything we could get that was loose so that we could stay in the air. And so we finally made it back. We didn't make it back to our base. We made it back to the first base that we could find in England. And we just went there, and then they trucked us back to our base, and then they fixed up the airplane. I don't know, it's probably a week or so, then the airplane was flown back to our base and we flew it again. So.
And you made that sound like no big deal, but I imagine while that was happening, there were some nervous guys on that B-17.
We were preparing for ditching, actually, because we didn't think we were going to make it back to the England. Like I say, we threw out the stuff, but we also prepared for the ditching. And the pilot says, you know your positions for ditching. Yes, I know mine. Okay, tell me where it is. And so each one checked in. I know where I'm supposed to be if we're going to ditch. And so everything was pretty well organized if that would have happened. And my position in the front, I was to go back into the radio room because that would be a bad place to be and you have to ditch. So everyone called in and says, yes, we're all set. So we're ready to go. Just give us the word and we'll go ahead and get to the positions.
And very relieved, obviously, you never got that word. Is that, when you get home from a mission like that, is that one that you guys celebrate a little bit?
Yeah, it's a celebration, all right, you know, and a relief more than anything, you know. So, and I don't know, it just seems like you're euphoric after having got through it and you're still alive. It was a celebration, all right. We would take two shots of whiskey instead of one.
Well, and you mentioned having that same plane, Busy Baby, for most of your missions, and you just described that mission where you weren't sure if you're going to make it. It makes me wonder how much respect and trust and admiration you had for your pilot.
Yes, we had a really good pilot, and the co-pilot both were. I think all of those guys were really good and dedicated, you know. So I was pleased with him, and I wouldn't have asked for another pilot under any circumstances because I was perfectly satisfied.
I'm looking at your list of missions here, and I see June 2nd of 44, you guys flew to France. June 4th of 44, you guys flew to France. June 5th of 44, you flew to France. What about June 6th, 44? Did you guys hear what was going on? Because there were a whole lot of planes in the sky that day.
I was on a three-day leave. We flew the day before. Okay, see, the 6th is missing. The 5th, and then it looks like it didn't fly again till the 12th. Yeah, so it looks like there's a week we had off. So that was pretty nice. The thing is, those were short missions, yeah. And they were actually, if you will, safe. Yeah. You know, there was any very little anti-aircraft gun, and the fighters had probably been pretty much taken care of by that time. So we felt like we kind of missed a couple of missions instead of going there for maybe a three-hour flight, go somewhere for 8 hours and get all shot up.
When you guys heard about what was happening, was it big news that the Allies had hit the Normandy beaches and attacked?
Of course, we were in England, in downtown London probably at the time we first heard about it. And so, it was really big news. We were on our way. We're going to finish this thing up. And the poor English people, you know, they'd been beaten so bad, felt sorry for them. But now they were beginning to see that this thing is going to end sooner or later.
Well, Well, it would be a long time, another year almost, till that war ended, but it would end before that for you because you got your missions in. When you went in, was it 25 missions and you come home?
When I went in, yes, it was. It was 25 missions and you come home, and then they shortly after that, they jacked it up to 30, and then they jacked it up to 35, but then they prorated them out. Depending on how close you were to 30, you know, or how much over 30 you were, they would prorate them out. So I ended up, I think, with 32.
But for a while, they keep changing the number, and you're saying, hey, am I ever going to get there?
That's exactly right. Okay, now you're going to fly 35. Said, oh, my God. So then they finally changed their tune about that a little bit, and they prorated where we were at that time so that we didn't have to fly the full 35.
Somebody's listening and says, well, what's the big deal? That's just a number. But no, it wasn't. I mean, you realize you beat some pretty significant odds, don't you?
You can take a look at this, where we were. You know, Zinowitz was where they were testing their missiles. Wernher von Braun, yeah. He was the head chief at Zinowitz at that time. And so it was our goal at that time. I don't know what time we left, but we were to catch the people in bed, and we were to catch them on a Sunday morning. So we probably got to the target like 6 o'clock in the morning so that they were still in bed and not aware of what was going on and not even thinking about us. And so we bombed that place, and they were making the so-called heavy water for the atom bomb and all that kind of stuff there. It was one of the most significant experimental stations for bombs and that kind of thing. So we were glad to do what we did, but I don't know how much it paid in the long run.
And that brings to mind another question. How good a picture or how complete a picture did you guys ever get of what damage you'd actually done or how significant one of your missions was going to prove to be? Did you have any sense of that at the time?
Yes, we would see the strike photos, but you have to really interpret those things, and we didn't get to that. They had the people that were really taking care of the photos, and they could spot things that we would never recognize. And so although we could see that, yeah, things are all blown up, but you don't know there's a lot of things that weren't. So the other people, they could tell that.
Again, just looking at your list of missions, I see one on July 7th of 1944, your 24th birthday, bombing an aircraft factory in Leipzig, Germany. Do you remember that?
Well, not really. But Leipzig was never an easy target either, for that matter. So, and do that on my birthday? No, it was a good birthday. I survived.
Amen. You've survived a few of them since then, too. When you found out that you were going to get to come home, what was that like for you? Because the war wasn't over yet, and you knew some of your buddies would still be flying. But were you excited about your opportunity?
Oh, yeah. We were waiting. We were watching our numbers, you know, and we knew how many we had to fly before we were able to go home. When the last one came, and yeah, that's the one you're really worried about. Am I going to get knocked down on the last flight? And so when it was over, wow, hooray, I'm going home.
Through all of those, I know it's hard to catalog them all instantly, but what do you think was the moment where you felt the most intensely a sense of fear or anxiety or doubt as to whether you would come home and see Marie again and do any of the things that you've done in all these years?
Well, the second mission, Berlin. Here's a picture of it. That's what you fly through. And it just doesn't seem any way possible that you're going to get through it. And you see, these airplanes are all out of formation, really. They're going to get picked off, no question about it. So they've been damaged, and they're out of position, they're out of formation, and they're easy pickings for the fighters now. So it just seemed impossible to get through that, but the majority of us did, so we made it.
Yeah, the picture just shows clouds of black smoke just about everywhere across the horizon and a few B-17s trying to get away from it. What seemed impossible wasn't, at least not for John Wagenhals and his crewmates. You did make it home. You got to marry your sweetheart, who you'd met at the shipyards before you headed overseas. And you may not have realized it at the time, but you hadn't flown your final mission. When we come back, a different plane, a different war, but more close calls in the sky for Bombardier John Wagenhals. Just celebrated his 94th birthday. And we'll have the rest of his story when Hometown Heroes continues after this.
I'm really trying to redefine the hearing aid in general. Today's modern hearing aid is vastly different from your father's or grandfather's hearing aid.
Nathan Lev, owner of Sound Advice, with an eye-opener for our ears.
We've got hearing aids now that are directly linked to iPhones. You can stream phone calls directly from your iPhone to your hearing devices without any intermediate piece at all. If you're on a jog and you want to listen to music, you stream music directly from your phone to your hearing device.
Sound advice with new innovative products and the best possible care by a licensed hearing aid professional.
Well, I'll be happy to give somebody a consultation. There's no cost to that. I'll give you all the different price points and then shop around, because you have to find not only a device that suits you, but a provider that suits you as well.
Begin your quest for better hearing. Call Sound Advice at 579-1310 or visit online at hearingaidsfresno.com.